Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Exercise may be an important treatment in the prevention of type 2 diabetes, but as Dr. David Wright is finding in his research, you might have a bigger battle getting rid of the fat than you'd expect. And David McLinden is using MRI technology to help uncover the cause of schizophrenia. And Dr. Peter Dunker of the Sustainable Forest Management Network is developing scenarios predicting what Canada's forests might look like in 2050. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. One of the biggest public health concerns today is the increasing amount of obesity. This is directly related to the increase in the incidence of type 2 diabetes. One of the researchers looking at what's behind this trend and how to treat it is Dr. David Wright. David is an assistant professor in nutritional science at the University of Alberta. With funding from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, he's investigating the link between exercise, insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, and fat.
And it seems like, anyways, that adipose tissue oxidative capacity metabolism seems to track fairly closely with whole body glucose metabolism and insulin action. So I think that adipose tissue is potentially a pretty good target if we want to try to tease out this specific mechanisms involved in the development of type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance and then obviously obesity as well.
Well, the ideas about the fat that we carry in our bodies, the adipose tissue, have actually changed recently, and it's a much more active thing than perhaps we would have thought in the past. What is the view of fat now?
Well, that's a good point that you brought up. You know, traditionally, adipose tissue was thought of as a storage site for excess calories. Didn't really do much, just kind of sat there. Didn't necessarily look that good, and everybody was trying to get rid of it, right? Dieting, exercise, etc. But probably within the last decade anyways, it's fairly well accepted now that adipose tissue or fat is a fairly active endocrine organ, and it secretes a host of factors that can affect whole body insulin action. So things like these hormones, which are termed adipokines or adipocytokines, some of these that are being fairly heavily studied right now would be leptin, resistin, adiponectin, and then, of course, free fatty acids as well. So those adipokines as well as free fatty acids can have some fairly profound effects on skeletal muscle. So there seems to be some crosstalk between muscle and adipose tissue in terms of the regulation of whole body insulin action. And what we're trying to look at now is the time course of changes in adipose tissue and then how it relates to the development of whole body insulin resistance, which is a pre-diabetic state, for lack of a better expression.
Well, when you look at these things that are being secreted from the adipose tissue, are they good for us? Are they necessary?
They're necessary, and it depends on what specific adipokine you're looking at. You can kind of divide them into the good guys and the bad guys. The good guys you could think of as leptin and adiponectin, and the bad guys you could think of as tumor necrosis factor alpha, resistin, and free fatty acids. So it's really a balancing act between those two groups of factors that are secreted from adipose tissue.
So the good and the bad, what effect do they actually have then on the body?
The major effect in terms of regulating whole body insulin action and glucose homeostasis appears to be at the level of skeletal muscle. So if we gave you a carbohydrate drink right now and we tracked where that glucose went in your body, about 75% of it would go to skeletal muscle. So from a quantitative standpoint, skeletal muscle is the most important insulin-responsive tissue in terms of glucose disposal, so clearing sugar from the blood. And those regulatory factors secreted from adipose tissue that I just mentioned seem to have a fairly marked effect at the level of skeletal muscle. So the good guys that I mentioned, leptin and adiponectin, have an insulin sensitizing effect, where things like resistin and TNF-alpha and free fatty acid seem to have an opposite effect. So they actually induce insulin resistance.
So there's a crisis now, we're being told, in terms of so many people suffering from obesity in our society.
What role then does that play in the work that you're doing?
That's a very good question. What I'm trying to figure out is, at least in severe models of insulin resistance and in type 2 diabetics, you see these alterations in adipose tissue function. What we're trying to tease out right now is how early do these changes occur in the development of type 2 diabetes. Once we can nail that down, what we're in the process of doing is intervening with diet and exercise interventions to see if we can prevent or reverse these early changes in adipose tissue metabolism and then see how that tracks to improvements in whole body insulin action. And to do that, we've been using a rat model of high-fat feeding. So we feed these rats a very, very high-fat diet, and we can induce insulin resistance in about 4 to 6 weeks. And then we're also doing concurrent studies where we actually swim train rats and we induce a training effect. So we're doing combination diet and exercise interventions to try to nail down some of these questions.
What does exercise do then?
Well, traditionally in skeletal muscle, it increases the oxidative capacity of that tissue. So it increases the ability of muscle to burn fat and to burn sugar, which is a good thing, especially for a type 2 diabetic. There isn't a whole lot known about whether or not exercise does the same things in adipose tissue, but we've done some preliminary experiments, and I think it's fairly exciting anyways, and we seem to see the same effect in adipose tissue that we do in skeletal muscle.
You're doing your work with rats. What does all of this mean then for people who have type 2 diabetes?
Oh, that's a good question. It's not new information that exercise is a good thing. You know, we've known probably for about 30 or 40 years that exercise causes these positive adaptations in insulin action and whole body glucose or sugar homeostasis. You know, even though we've known this for about 40 years, the sad fact is people aren't exercising. So I think ideally a big picture goal of mine would be, all right, let's find out the effect of exercise in adipose tissue. Let's figure out how exercise is causing these beneficial effects. And then let's try to find some non-pharmaceutical, non-pharmacological approaches that we can use to turn on these same mechanisms. Traditionally, a class of drugs called TZDs have been used to treat severely insulin-resistant individuals. And recently, there's been some evidence to come out suggesting that these drugs can actually increase the risk of myocardial infarction or heart attack. So if we can find an alternative approach to treat people that have severe type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, and that these individuals might not be able to exercise at a high enough intensity or long enough duration to induce some of these beneficial effects, if we can find non-pharmacological ways to turn on these signaling pathways, perhaps through diet interventions and, you know, just off the top of my head, antioxidants perhaps, you know, I think potentially in terms of healthcare delivery, that could have a pretty dramatic impact on the healthcare costs associated with type 2 diabetes, which I think is in the neighborhood of, off the top of my head, $10 to $15 billion annually in this country. So that's kind of my big picture.
One of the problems is that we do lead very sedentary lives. Like we drive to work, we sit in front of computers. A lot of our work is, you know, it simply doesn't take us around, get us moving. And yet some people, you know, they do exercise, but they find that even though they exercise, they don't necessarily lose any weight or get rid of that fat. So is there some sort of problem going on there that you just can't seem to exercise enough?
I think, and I don't know if this would be a popular opinion with some of my colleagues that they're actually involved in exercise prescription and exercise interventions, but I think traditionally what we've made the mistake of under-prescribing exercise. So most of the biochemical adaptations that we see in the lab, in an animal model anyways, is using a fairly intense and large volume of exercise to induce these adaptations. So we use a rat model of swimming, and they're swimming for 2 hours a day, 7 days a week for 4 weeks in a row. Now, obviously, we're not going to prescribe this to an individual that's never exercised before and tell them to get on a treadmill and run or jog for 2 hours. But I think that we should keep in the back of our minds that I think human beings are designed to do a lot of work and are designed to do a lot of exercise, and that the ultimate goal should be more intense exercise and a greater volume of it. I'm of the opinion that you know, this accumulating moderate to mid-intensity exercise throughout the day. I'm just not entirely convinced from a biochemical perspective and a mechanistic perspective that that is enough to really induce some of these adaptations. I think it's a good starting point, for sure. You know, something is obviously better than nothing, but I think we have to set our sights a little higher, raise the bar a little bit, I think.
Thank you very much, David.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
That was Dr. David Wright, an assistant professor in nutritional science at the University of Alberta. His research is supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. Schizophrenia is a mental illness that affects over 50 million people around the world. Medication helps control symptoms of the disease, yet very little is known about what causes it. That may change with the research of David McAlinden, a master's student in biomedical engineering at the University of Alberta. With funding from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research and the Alberta Mental Health Board, David is using magnetic resonance imaging to compare activity in different areas of the brain.
Schizophrenia is a mental illness, and it has a lot of symptoms. Some of the more common ones would be hearing voices, paranoid delusions, odd postures, and blunt effect.
And what's your interest in schizophrenia?
Schizophrenia is a disease that we don't know that much about so far. The cause of it is unknown, and we don't have any firm biological markers, any unambiguous signs that a person has the disease. So it's this particular technique that I'm using, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, we may be able to see some things with schizophrenia that help us understand it better.
With your master's research then, what is the exact problem that you're trying to look at?
We think that there's differences in the way that the brains of people with schizophrenia work compared with healthy people. And we're looking to identify some of those differences and from that see if we can understand what schizophrenia is, why it happens, and what it does to a person.
Now, you've been doing some work with the magnetic resonance imaging. So how exactly do you have that set up, and what does it tell you?
The magnetic resonance imaging, it uses the same kind of scanner that people might be familiar with from their own experience being in the scanner. But it looks at something, a signal that's a little bit different. It's looking at a difference in signal from the level of blood oxygenation. When a brain area is active, the level of oxygen in the blood is changed a little bit. And by setting up our task properly, we can identify these small changes in the blood oxygen level. And from that, we conclude that there is an activation in that area of the brain.
What are these tasks? How do the patients do them?
The task I'm using is a choice reaction time. So there is a left and right visual stimulus, and the subject will respond to the stimulus by pressing left or right button.
What does that do then?
In order to perform this task, there's certain activities going on in the brain. The person has to identify the stimulus and then take an action as a result. So there's areas in the visual areas of the brain and also in motor areas. And there's also an interesting area called the anterior cingulate cortex, which seems to be like an interface in changing an intention to act into an actual action. And so we're interested in seeing the activation specifically in this anterior cingulate cortex.
Well, what are you finding out so far? What are these things showing you?
The prior research that we're using, it's coming from electroencephalogram, EEG, and it shows that there is a relation between the activity in this area of the brain and the reaction time that a person has. So in schizophrenia, many of the patients have a slower reaction time than a healthy person. And so we're expecting to see a difference in activation in this anterior cingulate cortex in people with schizophrenia.
When you're looking at these images, what's involved in the analysis and what does it mean?
We look at individual small volumes in the brain, and we have a time series of that volume while the subject is performing the task. And we do a statistical comparison of that time series with a predicted time series from what we know when the task is being performed. Following that, these statistical values for each individual volume are overlaid onto a structural image of the brain to identify the brain anatomy.
When you're finished this project, how will the results be used? What do they mean in terms of further application?
We hope that we can understand schizophrenia better and understand what is causing the symptoms. And in the long run, that would lead to better treatments. As well, we hope with the healthy volunteers to be able to link some of the basic neuroscience and simulation models to what we see the brain areas activated in healthy volunteers in this reaction time task.
How much more do you have to do on your research project?
I've just started taking subjects for the project. I've scanned about 5 so far, and for the complete project, I'll be looking for about 100 volunteers.
So is that what you're looking for now, is some volunteers?
Yes, that's right. I'm looking for right-handed men between 18 to 50. And I'm looking for healthy people, for people with schizophrenia, and also people who are sons and daughters or brothers and sisters of people with schizophrenia.
So how would people contact you?
They can call me at 604-0048. And if I don't answer, then please leave a message and I will get back to them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was David McAlinden, a master's student in biomedical engineering at the University of Alberta. His research is supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research and the Alberta Mental Health Board. Almost half of Canada is covered by forest, yet forest ecosystems are constantly under threat by industrial development, environmental degradation, and now, climate change. The Sustainable Forest Management Network has embarked on an ambitious new project to determine what the future holds for our forests. By developing a series of different scenarios, SFM scientists hope to integrate the research they've developed over the last decade with strategic policies to ensure the future of Canada's forests is indeed bright. Leading the Forest Futures Project is Dr. Peter Dunker of Dalhousie University.
The way we are examining this in the Forest Futures Project is the following way. There are some factors that are outside our control and some that are within our control. So what Canada does internally with respect to how we allow industrial timber harvest to take place are well within our control. There are a couple of major global driving forces that have a lot of influence on what we can do and will do with our forests. Let me mention two. One is global climate change, and no matter what we might try to do locally, we won't stop global climate change. In fact, many people believe that even if we stopped putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases today, we would still be in for a considerable amount of climate change. So in the forest sector, the best we can do is respond to climate change and see if we can't make our forests more resilient to the ravages that climate change might bring. Another factor to move us into the economic domain is global timber markets, or global markets for forest products broadly. And the Canadian forest products industry is highly dependent on what's going on in those markets. So if those markets decide that the markets would rather get wood and products from elsewhere, well, that means we have a problem of selling timber and, or processing timber, and those factors are more or less out of our control as well. So some would argue that it's a good idea to, you know, relax the pressure on the forest from industrial timber harvest, and that would be a good thing. Others would argue that the more we can sell our forest products, the more money will be coming in so that we have financial resources to make the kinds of treatments in the forest that would keep them in good condition. So there, one would be getting the impression by now, given the factors I'm talking about, how complicated the story is when it comes to the long-term future sustainability of Canada's forests.
What about some of the other countries? Who are our competitors that way that might have, you know, take things out of our control?
Timber supplies are being grown in very special ways in some parts of the country that have never really been on the global market, for example, South America. There's a great deal of anticipation and trepidation about what will happen in Russia with the huge timber reserves in Siberia and when those will come onto the world market. And there are other spots as well. Europe is still a very strong timber-producing region of the world. Those are the main competitors I see when it comes to supplying the world with industrial fiber. So there have been suggestions that perhaps in a couple of decades the world won't want Canadian timber. That may be far-fetched, and those are the main competitors.
Well, the Sustainable Forest Management Network now, after all these years of work that you've been doing in terms of scientific research, you're now looking at what the future holds for our forests. How are you going about this project, and what are you looking at?
The name of the project is Forest Futures Project, but before we gave it that name, we called it the Scenario Analysis Project. So that early name betrayed the major methodological approach here. So the network has been sponsoring a wide spectrum of research taking more or less conventional approaches to research. And what we're trying to do in this project is to find a way that we can capture the expertise within the partners who have been associated with the network and amongst the researchers and get them to bring their best thoughts together to integrate into long-term pictures of what the forests and the forest sector may look like by the year 2050. So we have used a horizon of 2050, which puts us just over 40 years into the future. And the idea of the project is to write or prepare a set of fairly different alternative stories or scenarios about how the forests and the forest sector could unfold, given a set of assumptions about some of the key driving forces like global markets and climate change and like attitudes towards the forests here in Canada and so on, like our relationships with Aboriginal people. And we'll play those out in build up these storylines in a sense like future histories. So if we were to write today a history of Canada's forest sector from the year 1950 to 2000, we would have a 50-year history, and we could populate that history with lots of facts and policy turns and all that kind of thing. Well, we're trying to do the same thing with the future and write it as if it were a history from the year 2050 back. In the lexicon of future studies, it's a scenario-based approach to understanding the future.
What might those scenarios or those storylines be?
Well, that's very interesting. It's quite a labor to get good storylines framed. But I can tell you that we have now decided that the framework for those stories will be defined by two axes. One axis is an environmental change axis, which is dominated by climate change. The second axis is what we're calling it forest values, and it has to do with how the Canadian society wants to treat its forests and what things are important to us. On the forest values axis, at one end of the spectrum would be a continuation or even a return to a strong industrial focus, a materials focus, a goods from the woods, if I can put it that way. at the other end of the spectrum is a much more, a much gentler service-oriented view of the woods. So biodiversity conservation and control of water resources in watersheds and so on would be the dominant focus. And it's a very gentle and very participatory view of the world. And then at the other end, we could perhaps look at it more pessimistically and imagine that things like climate change will lead us into or will play out in very dramatic ways. One example might be, for example, if climate change comes along strongly, there may be more storms, there may be more fires, there may be more things like the mountain pine beetle epidemic, which many tie to climate change. So that's, in a way, it's a nastier scenario. So our expectation is that we will have four scenarios, and they will be decidedly different from each other as we write them up. And we will not assign probabilities of outcome, but it will be clear to various individuals as they look at these stories which ones they would really like, hope to have emerge, and which futures we would really like to prevent if we possibly could.
Thank you very much, Peter.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Peter Dunker, a professor of resource and environmental studies at Dalhousie University. He's leading the Forest Futures Project for the Sustainable Forest Management Network, which is centered at the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Genome Alberta, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Alberta Conservation Association, University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.